This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The opioid epidemic in Florida triggered a state of emergency, and it's also prompted police departments and sheriff's offices to equip their officers with Narcan. Narcan's an overdose reversal drug, but it's not as effective against some of the more potent opioids like fentanyl or carfentanil. Meanwhile, the state's imposing tougher penalties for fentanyl-related offences, including a 3-year mandatory minimum sentence for people caught with 4 grams of fentanyl and murder charges for dealers when someone overdoses and dies. So is the combination of better resuscitation tools for first responders and tougher penalties for dealers a good one? Are we heading back into a war on drugs? And what effect do you see that having on your community? We're at 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. You can also send us a tweet. We're at WMFE Orlando. Well, joining us is Orange and Osceola County Public Defender Robert Wesley. Thank you so much for being here.
Good morning. Thank you.
We're also joined on the phone by Lieutenant Dominic Galliano from the Orange County Sheriff's Office. He's the commander of the Street Drugs Unit. Thank you as well, Lieutenant Galliano.
Thank you for having me on, sir.
You can join the conversation too, 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. How do you see this war on drugs, if that's what it is, shaping up? You can also send us a tweet at WMFE Orlando. Lieutenant Galliano, I want to start with you. You've been in charge of the Street Drugs Unit for just under a year. What's it like out there?
Well, I can tell you that we are still seeing an increase in the number of our overdose cases related to opioid cases and opioid drugs. We had a significant increase last year, and we are building on that increase this year, unfortunately. So it has become the main focus of what we do in the Street Drug Unit. And basically what we do there is that we are where the rubber hits the road, basically where the dealer hands his drug to the user is where we come in. And we work those cases from that dealer to the mid-level dealer to the high-level dealer, because that is where the problem is occurring when it relates to the opioid crisis. So it is increasing, and it's still there. We are busy, as you can imagine, and we are going after these traffickers and these dealers aggressively.
Have you had to put more staff into this unit or delegate more staff to tackling or enforcing these cases now away from maybe looking into other crimes?
Well, as far as the narcotics end of it, yes, we've addressed this with more personnel. We've also reached out to our other partners in the Central Florida law enforcement community, which we work together with very well. So it is it is definitely a team effort and a group effort, and it does require a lot of manpower to go after this issue, of course.
So what kind of drugs are you seeing there?
Well, the heroin is what we're focusing on now. I mean, it's a big problem. We are seeing fentanyl, and you mentioned carfentanil in your opening piece there. We're seeing some of that coming onto the streets as well, which is extremely deadly. So, and we still have problems with cocaine, and now we're seeing issues with illegal marijuana grow operations with the Medical Marijuana Act being passed. So it's across the board. But like I said, the heroin overdoses are our problem. People are dying. People are overdosing every day. So we are making this our number one priority.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying you're seeing more marijuana grow operations. You're seeing a connection between that and the recent the legislation that's been passed into law?
Well, whether it's connection or not, we don't know. But we have seen an increase in the last several months, and we are anticipating an increase in that just for people trying to undermine or circumvent the new statute there.
Got it. Okay, so what about Narcan? How has that changed the equation? I'm wondering if the first time your officers got it, was there some reluctance or trepidation about using it?
There probably was some slight, because it's basically administering a medicine to a person, which is not really what a law enforcement officer is trained to do. But we went through training for this, and we started using it. And I will tell you, we use it often. So far this year, we've used it 50 times. That was as of yesterday. So that, potentially that's 50 lives that were saved by it. So now it's commonplace. Every deputy has at least one dosage of Narcan on them. And when they respond to these scenes, which they do on a regular basis every day, they quickly administer them, and usually they get positive results.
Of those 50 times it's been used by the Orange County Sheriff's Office, how many times would it be used on the same person, do you think?
I don't know the exact number, but I can tell you there's been several times when we've had duplicates. We responded to the same person more than once. Mm-hmm. Recently we had one where we responded to the same person twice in one day. But that doesn't matter to us. I mean, we're about saving lives, ultimately, first and foremost, so that's what our job is.
Robert Wesley, I want to bring you on this conversation. We were talking off air just before. You said that there's been some concerns with safe handling of some of these drugs, like fentanyl, for example. Just shed a little bit of light on that.
Well, there was a meeting yesterday and a discussion with the chief judge and other parties about whether what protocol should be in place for production of the drugs in the courtroom, whether it would be required in other cases, what safeguards would there be to protect anyone from exposure to the drugs. And it was a productive meeting, and it is a concern because no one should be put at risk. But we typically use plastic bags, like heavy Ziploc bags, for evidence production. Mm-hmm. And everyone around the table heard stories about cases when the bags came open unexpectedly. And so there's a need probably for a pre-trial determination about whether the drugs will be needed as a threshold, mm-hmm. as evidence, and then some concerns about whether the old plastic bag method is sufficient, and if we shouldn't go to a different, like, sealed glass container, test tube, something like that. So we're ahead of the game on that, I think, and share the concerns about exposure.
This is kind of new territory, right, though? I mean, would you have had those discussions 5-10 years ago?
Well, meth cases are not as prevalent in our jurisdiction as are in others, but they're standing court orders in other jurisdictions. We hope to study what they've had to deal with, the same risk of exposure. Meth probably is more toxic in the manufacturing part, mm-hmm. but we don't want anybody to come to the courthouse and have contact with any evidence that's going to do them harm. Same with a knife, gun, anything else. So it's just being ahead of it and being smart about what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. Dominic Galliano, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, your office is worried about accidental exposure when they're helping one of these overdose cases.
Yeah, absolutely. It's first and foremost in their thought process, I hope, when they're approaching these individuals. There's been several cases around the country, I'm sure you've heard about it, where law enforcement officers have been exposed to fentanyl through just their normal enforcement duties, whether it's coming across a powder substance. So we've enacted new safeguards for our deputies here recently, basically how to handle powder substances of any kind, because really you don't know what heroin is compared to cocaine, compared to fentanyl, until you test it. And unfortunately, mm-hmm. our procedures right now to test it requires us to actually handle it. So, yeah, our deputies are concerned about handling these drugs, packaging these drugs, and then, of course, as it goes through our evidence section and ultimately in the courtroom where Mr. Wesley was just describing, we have to have safeguards in place to make sure the bag, the integrity of the bag stays intact and it doesn't open up and expose other people.
What about the canines, the drug sniffing dogs? How do you deal with exposure if one of those accidentally gets a snout full of one of these substances?
Yeah, those canines have the same those canine handlers have the same concerns that the law enforcement officers do. Obviously, they don't want them to come across an open package or things like that. So they take their own safeguards and their own procedures to ensure that they try to minimize the dog exposure to an actual package, as opposed to maybe a box or a car. Mm-hmm. They're not going to expose their dog to the actual bag itself.
We're talking about the opioid epidemic and the law enforcement approach to it on Intersection. We're at 1-866-338-5252. I'd like to hear your thoughts. Are you concerned about the prevalence of these drugs on the streets? And what about the newer, tougher penalties imposed as well? To that end, Robert Wesley, we're at 1-866-338-5252. Love to hear your thoughts on that. Or you can send us a tweet at WMFE Orlando. Robert Wesley, Orange and Osceola County State it's a public defender, rather. Your thoughts on the signing of those laws into effect, the tougher penalties for drug dealing, opening up the possibility of homicide murder charges for people who sell drugs to somebody who overdoses. I'm wondering if that's going to change the volume of drug-related cases you're going to see coming through your doors.
Everything I read tells me that we can expect an increase in opioid abuse, which includes now fentanyl. And some of that is the medical profession themselves are trying to address the idea that doctors can cure all your problems and that we should all live a pain-free life. Mm-hmm. Our former medical examiner, Dr. Jane Garavalli, would always say pain is part of life and that doctors shouldn't be telling their patients that they can always walk around that, and that we have actually legally, medically created a group of people that are want to use opioids now to avoid all pain, and then that natural tendency to go. I mean, we went from morphine mm-hmm. to heroin, and now fentanyl, which is 25 to 50 times stronger than heroin, and that's the risk. But we think that incarceration and prosecution don't really solve things, because if poor people and opportunistic people want to sell drugs because that's the way to make money and make a lot of money, I'm not sure they read the papers and read the law about what the punishments are. But we think that we've got to deal with the desire for the drug first, mm-hmm. And on an ongoing basis, especially when we're warned that that seems to be the trend right now until more people die, apparently, so that there's an awareness that there is danger to it.
So you've got you're saying, just from the kind of what you're hearing from the medical profession, you're expecting more addiction cases. But what about from the sort of law enforcement point of view? If there are more prosecutions and tougher prosecutions for people for possession, does that mean more work for you guys?
Well, I mean, we will have the problems, but the community has the problem. It's not a question of whether we'll be overburdened with the drug cases. The concern now is a greater concern. These deputy sheriffs, like Lieutenant Galliano, are now not looking to arrest people. They're saving lives primarily because of the mishandling of this recognized drug. Fentanyl is used in every hospital as a post-operative pain mm-hmm. pain cure. It was never meant to be distributed on the streets by people who are making rough approximates or mixing it and whatever compound is unknown to the user. You know, I mean, our problem is that we told our kids that street drugs are impure and unsafe. Mm-hmm. So they went to the medicine cabinet and started getting the pain medicine that their family had, and then they started acquiring the pain medicine themselves. And then we turned that tap off with tougher drug laws about access to pill mills and access to opioids. And then middle class and suburb kids started shooting heroin in their necks. And then if the heroin's not available, then you know, their fentanyl was one time issued as a patch, like a nicotine patch to give a dosing of a pain-curing medicine. And then people are picking needles and pulling the pain medicine out of the patch to use that. And so the bigger high, the bigger high. But the problem is the consumer has no idea what's in that drug that they're buying. They had some idea of what morphine was or what heroin was. They certainly knew what a pill was. Mm-hmm. But now with this the higher toxicity, a little tiny bit of fentanyl can be over the line, whereas it would never have been that way with another substance.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to take a call here. We've got Doug calling in from Orlando. Doug, what's on your mind considering this debate at the moment?
I was wondering whether either of you gentlemen have read the book Dreamland, which talks about how all this is really the responsibility, the fault of the big pharma companies out there that really pushed all the Vicodin and OxyContin and all those drugs back about 10 years ago, and whether the state of Florida is going to step up and go after these companies and their executives, either criminally or civilly.
Mm-hmm. I haven't read the book Dreamland. Who's the author of that book?
I can't remember the author, but it basically talks about how the pill mill epidemic you were just talking about, how that started, and then when that was all shut down, when people ran out of money and couldn't afford it, they switched to cheaper Mexican brown heroin.
Hmm. Well, thanks for your call, Doug. I'm going to throw that one to you, Robert Wesley. Your thoughts on that? I don't know if you've read this book, but does this seem like there's kind of some political input needed here to get a handle on this?
Well, there are attorneys general and other states who have sought actions against pharmaceutical companies for the problem. They created the drug and hopefully for a purpose to sought relieve pain from people who needed it. But the problem is really in the use, the desire to, or the notion that there's a pain-free life available and that I can just take a pill and all my problems go away. And mm-hmm. That's a culture shift. That's a big culture shift.
I want to play a little bit of sound from a state attorney for Palm Beach County. This is Dave Arenberg. He spoke to NPR for a story which was on our airwaves fairly recently. Here he is. He says this new approach from the state is needed.
The person who is spreading this poison needs to be held accountable, and that will mean handcuffs and long prison sentences.
So that's Palm Beach County State Attorney Dave Arenberg. I want to come back to you for a moment, Dominic Galliano, with the Orange County Drug Enforcement Unit. I mean, is this a kind of a quick fix, putting more people behind bars if they, you know, arrested for possession and the like?
I don't think it'd be a quick fix, but I can tell you my stance on this is that we're never going to arrest our way out of this problem. We can arrest, you know, countless drug dealers every day, and we're still going to have the same issue. These enhanced penalties and these potential manslaughter or murder charges are beneficial to the deterrent side, to let these drug dealers be overtaken seriously, and we're not going to stop until we're able to prosecute them. But what you mentioned before about the new minimum mandatory standards, I think mm-hmm. that's a good step in the right direction, because that shows these drug dealers that we're taking it seriously. We're going to lock you up if you're spreading this poison, as that gentleman just mentioned, because that's exactly what they're doing. Whether we can tie them to a death or not, they're spraying this drug, which is ultimately killing these addicts, and they're preying on these victims. And usually these people that are trafficking in the drug, they don't use it because they know better. Mm-hmm. They know it's poison.
Is there, though, a risk, as Robert Wesley was mentioning, that the folks who are using may not be reading the newspapers or, you know, understand about these new statutes? Is there a risk that folks who are kind of down the chain and aren't perhaps the high-level dealers that you're going after are going to get swept up in these minimum mandatory sentencing?
Sure. That's always going to be a risk. And, again, that comes to the deterrent side. We all know that the first offense, you're not going to get prison time for possession of heroin, and likely not the second offense if it's a small amount. So they need to learn. They need to educate themselves through the criminal justice system by going through the process. You know, just to a certain point there, like I said before, nobody who is a mid-level or high-level dealer, for the most part, they're not using the drug because they know better. Mm-hmm. They know it's poison. They're preying on these addicts. And whether you're a small-time dealer or a mid-level trafficker, they're preying on other people, and they're killing them, whether they know it or not. And if they do know it, they really don't care.
Mm-hmm. I want to get one more call in here. We've got Kelly calling in from Daytona Beach. Kelly, you're on the air.
Yes. When we had this, when it became obvious about 10 years ago, the OxyContin problem here in Florida, and our state was the biggest export of that drug, that illegally, to the other states. And Governor Rick Scott dragged his feet, and then finally he did something, going after the overprescription and the pain of the pill mills.
Right. I mean, that's been a key part of Attorney General Pam Bondi. I mean, she talks about the war on the pill mills, but yeah, proceed.
Yeah, the drug companies. There's other states, I believe, Senator Manchin of Virginia, mm-hmm. he came out a while ago saying how the amount of pills that the pharmaceutical companies are pouring into small counties in Virginia is totally unnecessary. I blame the pharmaceutical companies. Mm. I really do.
Kelly, thank you so much for your call. I appreciate that. It sounds like, Robert Wesley, that there are some thoughts there that maybe action needs to be taken at a higher level than just on the streets.
Well, it was shocking, and we saw it up close and personal with the pill mills and mm-hmm. with the out-of-state people who came here because it was a ready source. But, again, the problem was created when people thought that they should not have to suffer any pain at all, and most of us would see the controlled substance and be able to walk past it. And some of us see a box of donuts and we're able to walk past it, and some of us aren't. Mm. And it's a lack of discipline. But I think the big deterrent effect really is seeing a friend die. Mm. That, you know, the users tend to know each other, have some relationship with each other. And unfortunately, that might be the most graphic exchange. It was with crack cocaine early when we had a lot of death. And we knew the older you were, the less likely you were to continue to use and survive it.
Robert Wesley is the Orange and Osceola County Public Defender. Thank you so much for your time.
Enjoy being with you. Thanks for the invitation.
And we're also joined by Lieutenant Dominic Galliano. He's the Street Drugs Unit Commander with the Orange County Sheriff's Office. Thank you so much, Lieutenant Galliano.
Thank you for having me, Matthew.
Still to come, July 4th weekend, for many means hitting the beach and firing up the grill. We're joined by someone who barbecues for a living. If you missed an episode of Intersection, you can find us on the NPR One app. You can also subscribe to the podcast. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. July 4th's a busy weekend for Pig Floyd's Urban Barbacoa in Orlando. That's where I met chef and owner Thomas Ward on a recent morning to talk about the art and science of barbecue and check out the smoker.
Every morning, Matt comes in at 4:30 in the morning.
Earlier.
Yeah, he shows up.
We've already placed meat in the smoker starting at 9 at night.
So we're cooking brisket and pork overnight. And at 4:30 when he comes in, he places the ribs. They cook for 3 hours on a dry rub, and then we take them out and we wrap them with this rib love. This right here is pork belly. We cook pork belly 3 times a week, which we use for our pork belly tacos. So we smoke it. This does 700 pounds. It's a Southern Pride. It's really the only way that we could smoke meat without having to tend it 24 hours a day, because this keeps temperature to the exact degree, and it's easier for us to just place it, and it's just gas assist, so it's very effective and very, you know, sequential in everything it does, so the meat always tastes the same.
And it keeps the ribs and whatever else we've got in there, pork belly, circulating?
Exactly. Keeps it circulating all the time, and basically the fat falls from up top, so it keeps everything fatty, I want to say. After he takes the brisket and the pork out, we place it in an auto sham so that we could keep it in temperature the whole day. And then all this morning preparation right now that's going on is for mainly the tacos. We have 7 different type of tacos, so we gotta prep everything. We have also our butter chicken, which is a yogurt marinated chicken that we marinate for 48 hours. We cook it fresh 3 or 4 times a day. You typically don't see tacos in a barbecue joint, and that makes it accessible for a lot of people. We have obviously all our recipes written and documented, but at the same time, I have 2 taste testers that go daily to the restaurant, both restaurants, one of them being my dad. So I get calls if something's off. Like, for example, if he goes over there and he tastes the rice, which we like rice. So if he tastes it, he just basically tells them to throw it away and start over. So it keeps quality going in both restaurants. And you can see it in some of the reviews, you know, that people say it's the same tasting food as in Mills.
Did your dad volunteer for that job?
He did. He did. He likes eating barbecue, and I guess he doesn't get tired of it every day. I get tired of it. I did the menu for 3 months. So after that, I got so tired of barbecue that I gave it a break. And, you know, I have the ribs basically once a week, just to make sure that they haven't messed up with the recipe. I definitely try the rice and beans every day because that's the simplest recipe in the book, but the most messed up recipe on a daily basis. So that's what I really taste every day, the rice and the beans.
Do all barbecue joints have the same kind of routine, or does everybody do it a little bit different?
I think everybody does it a little bit different. Everybody has different machines. Southern Pride seems to be one of the most popular ones, but everybody has different processes, you know. Most of the Texas barbecue joints, they tend to do it with only wood, so they have to have somebody there tending it all night. You have to be a master at that because everything has a different heat level and everything, so you got to be tending it all the time.
So there's a lot of practice, a lot of art that goes into that?
There is a lot of art that goes into that, so that's originally when I started, you know, I decided to go against that because it's just too hard to be able to maintain it, opening multiple locations and having pit masters working 24 hours a day. Because, I mean, it depends on the volume that you do. But I know Franklin Barbecue in Austin, Texas has people there 24 hours a day. And they start smoking at 12 o'clock at night, you know. So somebody has to be there from 12 o'clock till 8 in the morning, tending the fire, and then somebody comes in.
So it's tough, and they do a lot of volume, a lot more volume than we do. So
people are really into it, though, right? I mean, you get lines around the block for that stuff.
They do, yeah. That's amazing. I think he sells now 2,500 pounds of meat a day, which is outrageous. I mean, I wish I had a restaurant that people waited 3 hours every day. I even think people started a business of waiting in line and charging.
So there's this whole economy around barbecue in Austin.
Yeah, there is an economy. But he's one of the most popular ones across the United States, you know. So we have a tiny location compared to his. We're 1,600 square feet. So, you know, we try to move people in and out as fast as we can. Obviously, with not being pushy. But it's difficult to be able to maintain what he's doing. And he sells out at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I wish I could do that every day, you know. That'd be great.
So the wood chips is what gives the meat some of the flavor?
Yeah, exactly. We have kiln dry oak wood and pecan, right? So when you place it in the side here of the smoker, place it right here, and basically that fire turns on and heats it up and basically gives it that smoke. We try to use even less logs so that the smoke is not super heavy. But in some of those barbecue joints, I mean, imagine it's all oak or it's all hickory or whatever wood they use. So it's heavy. I mean, it's a heavy smoke, and you're only using wood to keep that fire alive. So it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work.
There are regional differences to barbecue. Do you think Orlando has a barbecue, or is there a barbecue that is unique to this part of Florida?
Well, that's interesting. I tend to believe, yeah, that regions have their own barbecue. North Carolina has their own barbecue. South Carolina has their own barbecue. Texas has their own barbecue. I mean, here, you got to remember, we have so many people from so many different regions. And we're also very international because we have so many people coming from all over. I don't think there is a Florida barbecue, let's say, per se. I think there is a mashup, you know. Our Four Rivers, for example, he does Texas style, right? I don't know what my style is. I would say our style is really, I mean, we're international, so I don't want to be boxed into that.
Maybe that is what Orlando barbecue's about.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess, yeah. I mean, it's really funny because everybody wants different things in the barbecue arena, and barbecue is so traditional, right? So we get people that ask, hey, when are you going to do mac and cheese, you know? Or somebody sent me a message the other day, when are you going to do mashed potatoes? I'm like, I will never do that because that's not my style, right? So some people like the traditional, some people like what's different. But, I mean, I would tell you, no, there's not an exact Florida style, but I think it's all a mashup, you know? And it works because everybody loves barbecue. Everybody loves barbecue. But it's tough when you hear, I talk to a lot of people all the time, and they're like, oh, yeah, I like to do barbecue at home. But the issue is it takes so long, and it's so time heavy that, you know, sometimes it's just easier to get in the car and go eat ribs, you know, somewhere, because they've already done the work for you. It takes so much time. And some people don't understand that we cook daily. So whenever we run out of meat, I can't just go and buy some more meat and just throw it on the grill. You know, it takes 12 hours.
So July 4th, you know, it's summertime. It's a long weekend. It's a holiday. What's it like for you guys?
It's a really heavy day. That day, actually, we do two smokes just because we have a lot of catering and a lot of people taking out. We do about 80 racks of ribs that day. And we typically sell out by 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So it's a really busy day. I like to let everybody leave early so that they could go enjoy it with their family, but sometimes it doesn't work out.
So if you're doing two smokes with this machine, how does that work timing-wise?
So we start the smoke basically at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And then at 4 o'clock in the morning, we take some of the meat out and we place more meat in, and we take the second batch out at 4 o'clock in the afternoon for all the to-go orders that are later on. So we just we just want to keep that steady stream and obviously fresh product coming out of the smoker.
Do you find, Thomas, that more people are choosing to go out and just have somebody take care of the food for them?
I think so. I mean, I'm originally from Puerto Rico, so it's a very traditional thing to cook, right? But it's just become so time heavy, right? And for everybody to do it, it's just so, it takes so long. And obviously, people are now in the time where they just want to get to enjoy the time off they have from work and, you know, not have to work and slave in the kitchen and then clean up and all that process. So typically, everybody that goes to the beach, you know, it's just, they don't want to work. They just want to go to the beach, enjoy, and have everything done for them. So I think they should leave the job to us.
You got a padlock on front of your smoker here. Has anybody ever tried to bust this thing open overnight and steal some of the product?
No, we've been pretty lucky. We put it there for security, really. Since this is a little, obviously, open, we didn't want anybody messing with the meat. And we've never had a problem here. It's been super safe. The Mills 50 area is super safe.
So what do you like to eat on July 4th?
I like ribs. Yeah, ribs is such a traditional meal, and I love ribs. I love our ribs. I love ribs in general. So I eat ribs, and sometimes I like baked beans. So we try to do a recipe that I have for baked beans that's really loaded with sugar. So that's the day where I take the day off from eating healthy and go for it.
Thomas Ward, thank you so much.
Absolutely, thanks.
Still to come, step through the doors of Blue Bamboo Centre for the Arts. Chris Cortez gives us a tour of the concert venue and recording space that's coming up on its first anniversary. If you missed an episode of Intersection, check out our podcast on iTunes or listen on the NPR One app. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Guitarist Chris Cortez started a record label back in 1986 in Orlando called Blue Bamboo Music. After living in New Orleans and Houston, he and his wife moved back to Orlando 2 years ago and started a recording studio and performance venue in a converted warehouse in Winter Park.
It was originally going to be an audio recording studio. That's what we had in mind. We started shopping around for properties to lease to do that with. And the idea occurred to me that if we were a video-audio studio combination with the ability to have a small audience in attendance, that we would be very unique in the studio, in the Orlando studio market. There aren't very many places like that. Where maybe imagine this place where a band could go to shoot a live video in front of an audience and get great camera angles and decent lighting and good sound. And to have all that happen in one place that would be flexible enough to do different kinds of groups, a big band one night, a small group another night. And our focus was originally just on music. And I think we had a much smaller vision in mind. And we came across this 6,000 square foot building, and the possibilities just sort of blew my mind. And at that point, I just got very determined about it and raised the money and went forward. We have our anniversary coming up in July 18th.
How's that year been for you?
Mind-blowing, really. I mean, I have no experience running a venue. I'm a guitar player, and then I became a record label owner, and I'm an audio engineer and videographer. But I think we can all, as humans, we can be a lot of different things. But this has definitely been a learning curve for me, trying to figure out how to deal with the city and permits and contractors and to get it built, and financing also, huge challenge. And then once it was built, then figuring out how to make it sustainable. Because it has to survive, or, you know, it has to be economically viable, or it won't survive. And getting people, enough of the right people to know about it, because we have a sort of a, I guess, an eclectic voice in the arts here that we're definitely trying to appeal to a local market as opposed to a tourist market. There are a lot of things that set us apart from our competitors here, I think.
Is there anything like this in the Orlando area, though? It sounds kind of unique.
I think there is. In terms of programming, the Timaqua White House, it has a very similar concept in terms of the kind of acts that they like to present. And of course, they're doing it on a donation model, usually once a week. That presents a lot of challenges for them, but we dove into this with a ticket-based model, trying to do it 4 or 5 nights a week. It's a lot harder. I mean, when you compare the two businesses, the scope of ours is much larger, but what we're trying to do is very similar. We're appealing to basically the same demographic of people, locals who are really into arts and not so much into the pop stuff and the touristy kind of stuff.
So it's 5 nights a week, but this sounds like a 7-day-a-week business.
It is very much, because part of our being a part studio and part venue is the business model that makes part of this work. Okay, if you have, there's only so many tickets that we can sell, and groups need videography, and I have to be paid to do the videography. So we developed a way that the groups can be paid out of ticket sales. And but then, of course, during the day, the next day, I'm busy editing and mixing whatever we did the night before. So, yeah, it's a real full day for me. I definitely have my hands full. We had 4 days off in a row a couple of weeks ago, and my wife and I spent all 4 days here working. The nights off were not days off. They were, you know.
You must have had a notion of how much work was going to be involved in getting this place off the ground, though, right?
Well, I'm not afraid of work. I have a great work ethic, and my feeling is if you choose things that you love to do, then it doesn't really feel like work. It's what you want to be doing anyway. I mean, if I made a lot of money, I'd probably go buy a guitar with it. You know, it isn't that's a tool that I use for my work, but it's also something that I desire.
Do you have a nice collection of guitars?
I do. I have about 8 or 9 guitars, and they all have names. One of my guitars has her own Facebook page.
Really? Has it got a lot of followers?
Loretta the Guitar, yeah, she does. She has a few hundred people.
You spent some time out in Texas before coming back and setting this place
before
up.
Before then, New Orleans.
Is Orlando a different place now from the point of view of the art scene compared to when you left?
Well, I think one of the reasons I returned here is because of the art scene here. In the 1980s, I led a band called Big Bamboo, which is sort of where the name of the company comes from. And Big Bamboo was a jazz fusion group in a town at that time that had no jazz fusion groups. And we found ourselves into a house gig, and it lasted for about 2 years, and we developed a large following. And jazz and jazz fusion started to become popular here, and we like to think that we were part of the catalyst that made that happen. And most of us who were involved in that group at that time remember it very fondly as sort of the beginnings of our musical careers and when we were really learning our craft. And so over the years, we've traveled around the country and done different things. I was a casino music director for a while. I have played in bands all over New Orleans, ran my record label when I was in Houston, toured with my own groups. But when my wife's corporate job ended in Texas, we were trying to decide where we were going to go next. I suggested that we come back to Orlando. Her parents are here, and this thriving art community is still here. Mostly the theme parks bring in all this talent, and then that frustrated talent doesn't have anywhere to express the other side. You know, everybody can play happy music for tourists. There's nothing wrong with that. It's wonderful, in fact, that these theme parks exist and can bring this talent to town. But if the talent is substantial, then they have their own message and their own songs to sing. And that's what we want to be about. And that's what the locals are interested in, of course. So we'll take an act that plays at Disney, like, for instance, Carol Stein. She works out at Epcot. She has a great gig at Epcot. And then she comes here and modifies her show for a different audience. And we just think it's wonderful.
Just describe what it's like for an audience member coming in here for the first time. You roll up to this building.
Sure.
Kind of looks like a warehouse. You walk in, what are you going to see?
Well, I think the first thing, when people come here the first time, they're usually a little confused. They drive down a street that is mostly warehouses and auto shops and things like that. And then they come across this big yellow warehouse. And it does have a sign on it that says Blue Bamboo Center for the Arts. But other than that, it kind of looks like a warehouse. And then hopefully our parking attendant guides them into a spot so they don't get lost. He'll usually spot them checking their maps and looking around trying to find the address. And then he'll guide them into a spot. And then they walk into our front doors. And the first thing they encounter is an art gallery. And so that's a bit of a surprise. You walk into a warehouse and you don't expect to see an art gallery. So, but there it is. There's art from local artists here, and the McRae Art Studios have contributed quite a bit, and it's just a building full of art. And then you go through another set of double doors, and now you're inside the theater. And the theater is a room inside a room, so it's virtually soundproof. And it feels like another world in there. You close those doors, and you're surrounded by art. And it is a 120-seat small theater with a 35-foot-wide stage. So it's very clear what the focal point of the room is when you walk into the room. It is about the performance. And it could be a theatrical event, it might be a musical event, it might be a classical music concert, it might be a jazz concert, it might be a blues band, it might be a funk band. We have all different kinds of music that we're playing here. We do tend to lean heavily on the jazz side of things, and we've developed a real following for that. In fact, Downbeat magazine named us one of the 200 best places to hear jazz in the world within 6 months of our opening, which shocked us. But it is a place that is very much geared toward the performer, and the music is center stage. The audience knows exactly what to do. We never have to ask anyone to be quiet. They all pay rapt attention to whatever's going on stage, and the artists usually deserve it.
So you didn't want the place to look like a nightclub.
That's true. We do serve beer and wine and soft drinks and snacks, but we definitely wanted to avoid being thought of as a bar. We want the entertainment to be the focal point, the reason people are coming here. We like people to think of us as a theater or a concert hall as opposed to a nightclub or a bar.
And getting named by Downbeat as one of the 200 best places in the world to see jazz would be great for your reputation. But what about the audiences? Are you packing the house for these shows?
Well, I think, you know, it's a hit and miss proposition. I think it would be for any new business and certainly for any new venue that's trying to find its way with no experience. But yes, we have had many sellout shows here. We have fans that just come back on a nightly basis. We have members who bought memberships so that they can come back without having to pay admission. And for, you know, they'll come to any show, bring a guest, and almost always, we have just an endless array of 5-star reviews on our Facebook page for people who come through and just go crazy because it's not like any place else.
Mm-hmm. What about the mix of artists you have here? Do you have artists from elsewhere seeking you out and saying they want to play here?
Mm-hmm. Yes, we have agents and the bands themselves that contact me from all over the country saying we're coming through Orlando and we heard about the Blue Bamboo and we want to play there. And, you know, I always try to accommodate them if it's worthy. I think the thing about it is we've got pretty high standards. We set the bar very high at first, and not everybody is, you know, good enough.
Mm-hmm. It's not just jazz, though, right? You have a big range of stuff.
My philosophy about booking the music is basically it's authenticity and commitment. If you are really committed to what it is you're doing and you're really honest about it, I think that comes through and I can feel it, whether you're a folk artist or a blues artist or a jazz artist or a classical musician. I think that it's, for me at least, that those points are readily apparent.
So this place is still pretty young. You're coming up on your 1-year anniversary, but Chris Cortez, do you feel like you've found some diamonds in the rough? Like, is this the kind of place where emerging artists, you know, this could be the place where they break out or the first place they get to show their stuff to an audience?
Boy, I hope so, and I think that's happened a little bit. I think, frankly, that's harder to do than you might think. We have a need to sell tickets here, and an emerging artist is going to have trouble selling tickets. So sometimes those people, we have a great example of that this Saturday night. There's a group called The Conglomerate. They are definitely an emerging local band from Orlando. I was just online with somebody who wrote into Facebook, who are these guys? Where do they play? I've never heard of them. And I gave him a paragraph about the fact that the last time they came, they didn't have any promotion. No one had ever heard of them, and they sold 2 shows out. So they're a really fantastic group. It's going to be a mind-blowing show, and they will sell tickets because they're going to go out and work and bring every one of their friends in and all their family members and everybody from their church, and everybody will show up for their performance, even though a more established act might have a better website, might have slick videos and all that kind of stuff, and still, you know, sell half the room. These guys are going to actually do the work. That type of an emerging artist can do really well here, and that's really what it's designed for. You know, if you play original music and you go into a restaurant or a theme park or a hotel, it's not that welcome. They aren't really interested in your original music. There's an expectation that you're going to play someone else's favorite song. And I don't want to sound like there's anything wrong with that. I make a pretty decent living playing other people's favorite songs. I'm happy to do it. But and many of the artists who play here do too. I mean, there's a commercial appeal to many of the acts that play here. So I don't want to sound like we're so esoteric that we're over everybody's head. It isn't that way. But the fact is, if you have an original voice, you need a place to express that. And if you do that well, if you're a good songwriter and yet you still don't have that big record deal, well, you've got to work it out in front of a crowd somehow, you know, and see how they're going to respond and what worked and what didn't work. And you've got to get that stuff up on its feet. That's, as a frustrated artist myself, I've always looked for places like that. But more importantly, if I do all that work, if I write that great song and I make a great album all by myself, I pay for it all by myself, then I do all that marketing work and I deliver that crowd, it really makes me mad if the club owner hands me $100 at the end of the night after he's made $2,000. So another part of our business model is that the artist owns their show. They're getting a percentage of ticket sales. They're not just getting a flat rate.
What's been some of the highlights, some of the best acts you've had through here in the last 12 months?
We just had Jade Simmons was here with Lillette's Rhythm Club. That was some show. I mean, that all right, every night is a fantastic memory, but the most recent ones are usually the ones that stick out. This was a show that was so special. It's about a woman who opened up the first club owned by a black woman jazz club in the 1940s. It was in Reno, and she became known as Queen of the Keys, so named by Duke Ellington himself. And big stars would come through her club, and she had a hot band, and this woman had great success throughout her life. Well, her daughter has written a play about her, and it's called Lillette's Rhythm Club, and this play is Broadway bound. They're in previews. They're touring to develop the show. And its star, Jade Simmons, is a classical and jazz virtuoso pianist, statuesque, gorgeous actress and singer. And she carries the show, and it's just amazing. But at the end of the show, the big surprise, Lillette herself comes out, 93-year-old Lillette, and plays Flight of the Bumblebee on the piano and blows your mind. And if you were already giving them a standing ovation after the Broadway show, but then here comes the encore. That's a memorable moment. When you see a 93-year-old woman get up and rock that piano boogie-woogie style on Flight of the Bumblebee, I tell you, that's something that'll make your day.
So do you see this place as maybe a part of encouraging musicians and artists to stick around in Orlando?
I hope so. I think maybe this is a little presumptuous on my part, but if we just created a place for me to play, I don't think that would work. If we had to, the only way this works is the fact that we created a place for a lot of people to play. And now that a lot of people are playing here, I'm most proud of the fact that there's a little economy that's created around that. There are 100 or so musicians every month who are paying for their daughter's dance lessons or their car payment or whatever, and they're looking forward to playing here again. And I think that's amazing.
Well, Chris Cortez, founder of Blue Bamboo, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The show's executive producer is Catherine Welch. Technical direction from Nicole Darden-Creston. Amy Green answered the phones. Our intern is Alana Campbell. You can find us online, listen on our website, wmfe.org, on the NPR One app, or download the podcast. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.